Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an expert on chemical weapons and look into why the Syrian regime has them, what they have, and who's in charge of them. Gregory Koblenz, a professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs and a member of the Scientist Working Group on Chemical and Biological Weapons at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C., joins us to discuss the impending U.S. strike on Syria over its use of chemical weapons against its own civilian population. Then we'll explore alternative scenarios to the punitive use of force in Syria and the possibility of President Obama using his visit to Russia for the G20 summit to sit down with Putin and find a way to end the bloody civil war in Syria rather than escalate it. Asher Kaufman, a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame, joins us to discuss what might end the bloodshed and destruction of Syria, short of a partition of the country that is not likely to produce viable states if the rebels end up with a landlocked rump state with no access to the Mediterranean. Then finally, we'll discuss the shadow of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney hanging over the Syrian intervention and the peculiar alliances between Democratic interventionists and Republican neoconservatives on one side and liberal Democrats and libertarian Republicans who are against the Syrian intervention on the other. Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, joins us to discuss today's strange political bedfellows and W.'s legacy of lies. And joining us now is Gregory Koblenz, who is a professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs and Deputy Director of the Biodefense Graduate Program at George Mason University. He's also a research affiliate with the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a member of the Scientific Working Group on Chemical and Biological Weapons at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Living Weapons, Biological Warfare and International Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gregory Koblenz.
Thank you for having me.
And let's sort of begin in the beginning, if we can, with Syria's chemical weapons arsenal, which is fairly substantial. I take it that they have them in the first place as a deterrent against Israel's nuclear weapon. Is that why they have them in the first place?
That's correct. Syria started developing their own chemical weapons program in the 1980s in response to the threat they perceived from Israel, both on the from nuclear weapons and also from Israel's very large conventional military.
And why is it then that Israel has gone after Syria's weapons of mass destruction in terms of a North Korean reactor that they bombed some time back, but yet they've allowed this vast arsenal, which according to this new French report that's come out, there are several hundreds of tons of sulfur mustard, tens of tons of VX, and several hundreds of tons of sarin.
I mean, Israel has been very wary of any country in its neighborhood developing weapons of mass destruction, and they've gone to great efforts to prevent a lot of that proliferation. They put, I think, nuclear weapons, though, in a different category from chemical weapons, in part because there are defenses against chemical weapons. You can shoot down the missiles, you can have gas masks, you have antidotes to be used against them, so there are defenses available. You can mitigate the consequences of a chemical attack. But nuclear weapons, right, there is no real defense against them. They have enormous destructive capabilities, and so they pose a different kind of threat. So I think Israel maybe was focused more on the most dangerous threats they perceived, and that's why they went after the reactor, whereas the chemical weapons threat, while significant, is not on the same order of magnitude. And also, it's a much harder target to go after. The Syrians had one reactor that they were building. It took a very small airstrike for Israel to destroy it, but chemical weapon facilities can be dual-use facilities, can be industrial facilities. The Syrians reportedly have four or five of them, and so that maybe was a more difficult target to go after as well.
So the French apparently have provided a fairly comprehensive report that talks about the command and control of Syria's chemical weapons under a Syrian Air Force organization known as Unit 450. Tell me more. You've studied the report. So what's your sense of what we've learned there?
The French report is very detailed. It's actually more detailed than either the American or British reports have been released so far. And there's a lot of information about not just what kind of chemical weapons they have. And according to the French, they have, as you said earlier, they have mustard, sarin and VX, which are the last two are nerve agents, and they reportedly have those in binary form, which is a more sophisticated form of chemical weapon. And the Syrians have a range of delivery systems, rockets, missiles, aircraft-delivered bombs. And in addition, the French did discuss to limit extent some of the command and control arrangements around those weapons. And apparently the Syrian regime has entrusted an all Alawite unit. So this is a unit made up of people from the same sect that Bashar al-Assad is from, that are in charge with filling these weapons and securing them. And this is outside of the regular military chain of command.
And would that be similar to what Saddam Hussein had? Didn't he have people from his Tikrites, as they were called, those from his hometown?
Yeah, so it's actually very common for militaries to have two chains of command for dealing with either nuclear or chemical weapons. One is the regular military chain of command, which would have control over the delivery systems, such as the artillery or the airplane. And there'd be a separate unit, very elite, hand-picked so they're loyal to the regime first and foremost. In the case of Iraq, they were mostly Tikrites. In Syria, they're Alawites. In the Soviet Union, they were picking people based on their loyalty to the communist regime. And so by having two parallel chains of command here, it ensured these weapons could only be used when the leader gave the order. And this protects the leader from his own people using the weapons against him, or them getting out of control, or getting diverted, or used in an unauthorized way in somehow.
And again, I'm speaking with Gregory Koblenz, who's a professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs and Deputy Director of the Biodefense Graduate Program at George Mason University. He's also a research affiliate with the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a member of the Scientist Working Group on Chemical and Biological Weapons at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. And he's the author of Living Weapons, Biological Warfare and International Security. And in terms of command and control over Syria's chemical weapons and this unit 450 that we were just talking about a second ago that can fill them up in binary, if they have the sophisticated binary weapons, those are when the chemicals are kept separate and they're combined when the projectile is fired. Of course, those that are either apologizing or in denial about what Syria has done, the Russians and the regime itself, are saying it doesn't make any sense for Assad to do this, and ostensibly it doesn't make any sense. So do you have any understanding of why these weapons were used?
Well, I think there are a couple of clues, but at this point it's really just speculation. But there has been a longstanding rebel presence in the suburbs of Damascus, which we know has been a thorn in the side of the Assad regime. And for him not to be able to control his own capital definitely does not look good, does not help morale of his own forces, and that might be creating internal tensions within the regime. And so this might have been part of a concerted effort to finally cleanse the capital, which would be operationally significant, but also symbolically important that Assad is back in control of his own capital city. We do know that the chemical attack that happened was done in conjunction with a concerted conventional military effort as well to try and seize this territory and get the rebels out of the suburbs of Damascus. So this was not an isolated incident. This was not random. This was a calculated move that was coordinated and integrated with a bigger conventional military counterinsurgency operation as well.
So I take it, though, that first of all, I don't know that there's any military way, if this strike that's supposed to take place after this congressional vote sometime, I imagine, next week, there would be there's no military way to neutralize these arsenals, given the scope of what the Assad regime has.
The U.S. has tried to develop what are called agent defeat munitions for many years, and these are weapons that could neutralize a chemical or biological target. But the problem is that they are basically unproven and would not guarantee 100% safe disposal of the weapons that they're targeted at. So it's unlikely that the U.S. would be able to attack, let alone destroy, serious chemical weapons from the air. There are just still very significant risks of local contamination and even collateral damage that probably rule such targets off limits.
So if there's no military way to neutralize these weapons, would a military strike, in your opinion, increase the likelihood that more of them would be used?
Well, the other option is to go after the delivery systems, because even if you cannot go after the actual chemical bombs and missile warheads, you can still attack from the air and destroy the rocket launchers, the artillery, the aircraft, the Scud missiles. And without a delivery system, these weapons are not going to be of danger to the region or to the rebels as much. So I expect if there is a military operation that it will focus more on going after the delivery systems that the regime has rather than the actual chemical stockpile because of the problems with not being able to destroy it safely and reliably.
But wouldn't that change the configuration on the battlefield? That would be intervening. The assumption here is that this is a political attack by using military force for political objectives as opposed to military objectives, and that often it's been said that the U.S. doesn't really want to get involved in this war. If you got involved to the extent that you knocked out their Air Force and all their delivery systems, then you would really be tipping the balance, wouldn't you, in favor of the rebels?
If you went to that extent, then yes, it would definitely tip the balance in favor of the rebels. But what I think Secretary Kerry, Secretary Hagel, and Chairman Dempsey have been saying is that one of their aims is to degrade Syrian delivery capabilities. So you don't have to destroy every last artillery tube or rocket launcher, but if you can destroy a significant amount, which would make it harder for him to launch chemical attacks, would also make it harder for him to launch conventional attacks against the rebels. And I think that is a, from the U.S. perspective, that's still a positive result of such military action. So I think it will remain limited. It will take in those types of targets into account, but not to the extreme of trying to use it to actually tip the balance fundamentally on the battlefield. But there would definitely be knock-on effects, or as Secretary Kerry said, downstream effects on the regime's ability to attack the rebels.
Well, isn't there also what will obviously happen is that the U.S. will be changing the subject. I mean, at this point, it's the Assad regime that have crossed the line and used weapons of mass destruction against their own people, which the last time that happened was Saddam's attack on the Kurds. That should be the subject, surely. The minute the U.S. attacks, won't the whole narrative change? The whole world will be once again saying, there's the United States attacking some poor, beleaguered third world country.
There's certainly a risk of that, but I think the severity and magnitude of what the Assad regime has done in killing 110,000 of its own people, I don't think there's that much sympathy for the regime to start with. The chemical weapon attacks are pretty well documented. You can see very sadly graphic pictures and videos of what the effects of these chemical weapons are. And these are not weapons being used on the battlefield, right? Whole families were killed by these nerve agents while they were sleeping. So I don't think the idea of the Assad regime being the victim of a bully, I just don't think that, I think most reasonable people will see through that. And that's not something that will get a lot of resonance. I think that the fact that a dictator is using weapons that 98% of the world has signed on to a treaty saying these weapons are, you know, inhumane, barbaric, have no place in a civilized nation. I think most people would support the idea that these weapons should not be used. And so the actions the U.S. takes to try and enforce that norm and uphold it is something that actually benefits everyone, right? Protects everyone from chemical weapons. If one dictator is allowed to use these weapons, it only emboldens others to think that they can develop them and use them with impunity as well. So I think there is a broader story here. It's not just about Obama versus Assad or U.S. versus Syria. And I think it's important that that message gets out. And I think most people will appreciate that and understand that.
But in terms of morality and humanitarian values, we haven't seemed to care too much about the fact that 100,000 civilians, mostly civilians, have died so far. So why all of a sudden are we concerned about the loss of life in Syria?
Well, I think people have been concerned, and there's been a lot of pressure put on the Syrians and their allies to negotiate, to find a political settlement to the conflict. And clearly that has not worked, but I think there's been a lot of pressure there. And the U.S. has been, and other countries have been, trying to alleviate the humanitarian suffering caused by this civil conflict. But for good reasons, lots of countries have been very reluctant to intervene militarily in the civil war. So lack of military action does not mean lack of interest, but when you get involved militarily, it is as you said earlier, it is another level of commitment. And I think this chemical attack, which is not the only one that's happened, according to the British, it's happened 14 previous times. This was not an isolated incident. This was just the latest escalation by the regime, and using a weapon that 189 countries have outlawed, that is kind of the straw that broke the camel's back and is the immediate trigger, but it is on this background of all this other death and destruction that's occurred. So I think it has to be seen in that context. It's not an either-or. This was on top of it, and this is just what made it an unacceptable situation to continue as is.
But if this is just simply punishment for crossing a line, even though 100,000 people had died prior to this line being crossed, I mean, there are two avenues here. You can either find a way to negotiate your way out of this slaughterhouse, or you can try and end the slaughter by using greater force, for the want of a better description. So what's the point of a punitive attack then? If, you know, where is the morality of a punitive attack if you're really concerned about saving this country from itself?
Well, if this was just going to be a purely symbolic pinprick attack, then it would not, I think, be the proper response. At the same time, you do not need to, you know, invade the country of Syria in order to have influence on the outcome of the fight now between the regime and the opposition. There's a lot in the middle, and I think that is what President Obama and the Congress have been trying to find, is what is the right balance between supporting U.S. national security interests, upholding this global prohibition against the use of chemical weapons, and trying to help the opposition secure their freedom from the Assad regime. And that is a tricky balance. Some countries want to go further. Some countries want to do less. But it's now the point where the regime is acting in such a way that this is no longer an issue that can be put off and put off and put off. And I think that's why we are coming up to this, you know, this fundamental turning point in the conflict here.
But one of the things that would seem that the U.S. and Russia has in common here, and after all, the president will be in Russia on Thursday and Friday. He won't be meeting with Putin after the G20, which in retrospect, it sounds like he should be meeting with Putin, because my understanding is that the U.S. and Russia have this simple thing in common, which is neither wants Syria to end up in the hands of an al-Qaeda-affiliated group like the al-Nusra Front that appear to be the most effective fighting force on the rebel side. So isn't there a common interest here?
There is, and the idea that you want to have a moderate regime take power that is not dominated by jihadists or similar groups is definitely a shared interest. And to the extent that the U.S. and Russia and its other allies can agree on that desired end state, then they can try and work backwards to figure out what do we need to do now to get there. And so hopefully this will be on the agenda at the meeting. Hopefully the U.S. and the Russians will talk about it either bilaterally or multilaterally. And even though Russia has opposed U.S. Use of force and threatened to veto anything in the Security Council, there is a shared interest here. So the extent that they can focus on that, there might be some progress that we see in the course of this meeting coming up.
And would that be sufficient, do you think, to make it unnecessary to pull the trigger? In other words, use the maximum leverage of a threat of a strike against Syria to stop these people from killing each other, because apparently they really hate each other and there's blood on all of their hands and they're just spiraling into the abyss.
I mean, these types of conflicts are not necessarily driven by ancient hatreds that never change. There are facts on the ground that that trigger political violence, And if you can change the facts, then the incentives for violence go away. So it is possible, and we've seen this in conflicts in the Balkans, in North Africa, in other countries, where you can remove the conditions that are causing the conflict. So there are ways to deal with once Assad leaves office, how do you then organize the governance of the country? And that there are many different forms that can take, and it's a matter of what is the combination of power sharing, assurances to former members of the regime that that they will receive amnesty or reconciliation. To what extent is there a reconstruction effort that all members of Syria, all different ethnicities and nationalities, can benefit from? So there are lots of things that can be done aside from that are not dealing with these immutable so-called ancient hatreds that have just been kept in check by Assad's iron fist. So by no means are there any simple solutions here, but there's more, I think, room in the gray here for both sides to reach some kind of negotiated settlement.
Well, Gregory Coblentz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Gregory Coblentz, who is a professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs and deputy director of the Biodefense Graduate Program at George Mason University. He's also a research affiliate with the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a member of the Scientists Working Group on Chemical and Biological Weapons at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Living Weapons, Biological Warfare, and International Security. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into alternative scenarios to a punitive strike against Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Asher Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace and headed its Middle East unit from 2004 to 2005. Asher Kaufman is the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon, and his forthcoming book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syria-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asher Kaufman.
Thank you for having me.
And there is this, of course, impending American strike on Syria, subject to congressional approval, which indications are that it probably will come, although there'll be an opposition, unusual coalitions of doves on the Democratic side and libertarians on the Republican side against it, and the interventionist Democrats and the neoconservatives on the Republican side for it. But I imagine, well, let's start with that. I imagine the president will get the vote, right? It'll
right.
probably be close, but he'll get it.
Yes, that seems to be the case. This is the message that we just got now from the Senate, the Congress, the Committee on Foreign Relations, that have voted in favor.
So, obviously, this is a political strike, not a military strike. I mean, it's a military strike, but it has political purposes as opposed to military objectives. Would you agree?
Yes, I fully agree. I mean, the purpose is primarily political, and all the talks about normative considerations, which are in their place. There are clear normative questions here that have to be addressed. I think they are superseded by the political considerations that come behind this this strike. We should be guided by the normative issues, but we should have been guided by it, you know, for the last 2.5 years. 100,000 people died in Syria before chemical weapons were overtly or exposed to be used, as we have discovered recently. But nobody in the United States really openly spoke about intervention. And now with this very unfortunate 1,400 deaths, many in America and in the international community seem to think that their death is somehow different from the death of the 100,000 that died before them.
Well, given that moral inconsistency that we have refused to do anything about the 100,000 killed by conventional weapons, and now we're prepared to do something because 1,500 people were killed by chemical weapons, I imagine the issue here is crossing the line and the use of WMD, which unfortunately so much of this debate is clouded by the legacy of Bush and Cheney and the lies to get into that war based on WMD. I mean, it's extraordinary how much the ghost of George W. Bush haunts this whole episode.
Yes, absolutely. This is why Obama needs to be more forthcoming about evidence, about proof, and needs to tell us as much as possible about the evidence. And, I mean, it would be futile now to go to the UN and have a public display as Colin Powell had back in 2003. What needs to happen now is to go with this evidence to Moscow and to get the Russians on board. And I would even say go to Iran and reach out to Iran and get the Iranians as much as possible on board. There is a new president, a new spirit. He has just wished a Happy New Year to the Jewish people. This did not happen with the previous president. So, not that this is an indication of a change of foreign policy coming from Iran, but still, Iran is a major player when it comes to the fate of Syria, and this is one of it's one of the players that the United States have to take into account in these deliberations.
And in terms of Israel, Israel's been pretty silent on this, haven't they?
I mean, officially silent, but you have heard, we have heard calls from actually senior members of the government pushing Obama to demonstrate more resolve and strength and finally strike Syria. Even Avigdor Lieberman made some references to the normative elements that have to be addressed. And just like in other parts of the world, in Israel as well, it's more political than anything else. And talking about normative issues is clearly, I mean, from the Israeli perspective, has very little to do with the real considerations or real concern with the normative issues that the Syria quagmire brings to the fore. Has to do with other issues, but formally, as at least the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, has been the policy that he has been leading is Israel remains silent and does not officially respond to this escalating situation with an impending American strike.
Again, I'm speaking with Asher Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace, heading up its Middle East unit. And his forthcoming book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syria-Lebanon-Israel-Tri-Border Region. And, of course, the reason that Syria has chemical weapons and has a substantial arsenal is because it's what I guess it's a kind of poor man's nuke. The Israelis have got nuclear weapons, and this is their means to have some deterrence. I imagine, given that they supposedly at least according to French intelligence, have several hundreds of tons of sulfur mustard, tens of tons of VX, and several hundreds of tons of sarin. This is also, I think, given their use of it, which has been going on for months apparently, the Israelis presented the White House with evidence some time back, which the U.S. downplayed. What's your sense of whether or not there'll be more chemical weapons used as opposed to less because of an American strike?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question. What would happen the second after a strike takes place in Syria? Would they use chemical weapons more? My suspicion is that an American strike, a limited American strike, would not be able to eliminate Syrian chemical capabilities, and the Syrian regime, or it's not clear if it would be the regime itself or units that support the regime but are not controlled by the regime, that they would self-initiate the use of chemical weapons. It's a very, very murky future that awaits us. And this is one of the major concerns of this strike, at least from my perspective. I'm thinking about what would happen the day after, or, you know, even the moment after the strike, an American strike takes place. Would it reduce violence? Would it increase it? And my hunch is that it would increase violence and not won't reduce it. That's my major concern. This is why I'm so strongly in support of, before any strike whatsoever, there has to be some talks involving the United States, Russia, and also Iran. Without that, we may well end up with further violence after such a strike. And the Syrians have had these weapons, just like you said. This is the poor man's weapon of, the alternative to nuclear weapons. What is interesting, obviously, is that Israel has allowed all these years Syria to accumulate chemical weapons. I mean, Israel had, according to, you know, international reports, Israel struck twice against Syrian nuclear facilities that were in the making. But for, I don't know how many years, 30, 40 years of accumulating chemical weapons, Israel has not lifted a finger against that, which is another interesting point to consider, that when one accumulates so much chemical weapons, one would think that, you know, they are there to, that there would be a day that they may be used, and this is what we are seeing now. I mean, the issue of holding, obtaining and using chemical weapons are grave, and they pose major normative questions. But we have already, you know, we've already seen the United States in the 1980s saying nothing about Iraq's use of chemical weapons, because Iraq was then the darling of the United States. And so as much as I would like to think that the world operates, should operate according to these normative values, it is clear that the states, leadership, they have other considerations to their actions.
So, Asher Kaufman, you mentioned earlier that you thought the U.S., before they pull the trigger, they should be talking to Russia and to Iran. Of course, talking to Iran would be highly unlikely, even if there is an opening with a new leader there. Talking with Russia, though, of course, is going to happen in any case on Thursday and Friday. The G20 is taking place it's already underway, but President Obama will be there in St. Petersburg. Now, he canceled the meeting after that, after the G20 with Putin over the Edward Snowden affair, which, in contrast to the crisis over Syria's WMD, you'd think that some adult supervision might be required here. You know, these people better forget about their problems they have with each other and deal with a far more serious question.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, I'm sure that there is something that Russia would like to get from the United States, and I'm sure that bringing Russia on board, doing something against Syria's use of chemical weapons would cost the United States some capital, some concession. But this is, you know, this is the art of politics and the art of diplomacy. It will not come for free for the United States to get Russian support, but this is inevitable. If you want to make any constructive progress with regards to Syria, you have to get the Russians aboard. And I would disagree with you that the door is closed behind Iran. I mean, the Iranian regime is, you know, it's a rational player that has its own interest, its own. They are thinking about their own interest in this affair, and it is possible, I think, to reach out to them and to try to get their consent that indeed chemical weapons is, you know, it's unacceptable, that this is a red line, and that Iran has to be supportive of that red line. And also there would have to be some concessions made, but this is a time to speak before you make any military move. And the only viable entities that you could speak with that could actually make a difference are Russia and Iran.
Well, I was suggesting that talking with Iran is highly unlikely. I wasn't suggesting it's not a good idea. I think it is a good idea. And unfortunately, the U.S. is trapped, as it always is, in dealing with these so-called rogue states, is they think that talking to somebody is a reward. And they construct situations with sanctions and et cetera, where you would, in effect, lose face if you did talk. And all of this pressure they put on Iran over its nuclear program would be out the window. At least that's the thinking inside the White House, that to talk to Iran would be tantamount to rewarding them for bad behavior. And that, unfortunately, applies to all of these states, you know, Syria and North Korea. That's the mechanism that we operate by, and it's really counterproductive and I think counterintuitive.
Yes, no, I agree with you. This is the challenge of dealing with countries like Iran and North Korea. But again, if the purpose is dealing with Syria, then the key lies, you know, in very particular places in the world. And there are back channels, diplomacy. America doesn't have to, you know, you initiate the talks and see where it leads you. And who knows with this new president what, you know, how things could evolve.
Well, since, Asher Kaplan, since you've specialized in cartography and contested frontiers in the very region that we're talking about, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and the tri-border region, there's an assumption that the end of this agony will probably result in a petitioned Syria with the Alawites moving up onto the northwestern coast of Syria around Latakia and the mountainous areas there, and the rest will be sort of Sunni controlled. And that at the end of the day, because of the, in fact, that it may be the chemical weapons arsenal that will guarantee them some territory as opposed to being overrun and slaughtered, if indeed we were to arm the other side sufficiently to overrun them. It would seem that at some point or other, you have to call for a ceasefire and work out these cartographical arrangements, given that all of the cartography in that part of the world was put together by the French and the British.
Yeah, but I'm skeptical of these scenarios because, you know, Africa has been partitioned in a very similar way. Most of the colonial world was divided, you know, in offices, colonial offices in London and Paris. And these boundaries, all in all over the world, has remained intact with very, very few changes. If you look at the Lebanese civil war, during the heyday of the civil war, everybody was talking about, you know, the Balkanization or cantonization of Lebanon. That eventually did not happen. And I think we are heading for a very long civil war in Syria. I am not sure it would conclude with the disintegration of Syria. Additionally, the scenario of having the Alawites retreat to the mountain and establishing you know, a sort of an independent entity there is very, very difficult to imagine, for the simple fact that this is the only access of Syria to the Mediterranean. Without the Alawite region and the coast west of it, Syria has no access to the Mediterranean. No regime in Damascus or whatever would allow that to happen, to lose the access to the Mediterranean. Latakia is the one and only port city of Syria, and it's on the other side of the mountains, and it's predominantly Sunni with strong Alawi presence. But I cannot envision any regime that would rise after this civil war in Damascus that would give up access to the Mediterranean. It would turn Syria into a landlocked country. And so whatever scenario of Alawis retreating to the mountain and establishing a stronghold there is very challenging, for the very simple fact that I cannot think of that happening without a major challenge because of the issue of access to the Mediterranean.
Well, just in closing then, Ashraf, and the alternative is that these people who clearly hate each other and have been murdering each other in the most savage way, they've just got to find a way to start to talk to each other and make some kind of a deal to hold that country together. I mean,
it's not the first civil war that we have experienced in the last 200, 300 years. Civil wars have happened elsewhere, and they eventually run out their course, and there is an agreement, and then people start licking their wounds and trying to think about reconstruction and reconciliation. And it's very difficult to think about it now, but this is the only way out for Syria in the future.
Well, Ashraf, and I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Ashraf Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace, where he headed up its Middle East unit. He's the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon, and his forthcoming book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syria-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. And we're going to take a brief station break and come back talking about the shadow of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney hanging over the impending Syrian intervention.
دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي وعسيني
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And we were discussing the Colin Powell's famous presentation to the United Nations, where clearly, very cynically, Dick Cheney, President Dick Cheney, thought he was the best guy to make their case, which he was. He made a very good case. The only problem was it was based on lies, and how the shadow of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney are hanging over this Syrian intervention. Is there any way for Obama to make a case and break through that?
I think it's very hard. I think that kind of atrocity politically in the foreign policy of a nation is hard to overcome. I must say the Democrats, especially the liberals, the Obama supporters, strike me as a parallel to the famous generals who are always fighting the last war. I think they are in the grip of irrelevant experience. That was an atrocity, but this is not Iraq. It certainly is not Libya. What these two instances, Syria and Iraq, do have in common, of course, and what the Obama administration has in common with the George W. Bush administration, is that no one at the higher levels of American foreign policy knows much of anything about the country in question. We didn't know Iraq when we invaded and committed the depredation that we did. We don't know Syria now. And, of course, that's doubly true for the Congress of the United States and for the media who are beating the drums here, both for and against. So you've got a kind of common denominator of ignorance. I think a lack of principle on the part of the liberals, who otherwise would be espousing the principle of intervention for human rights purposes, the object lesson of punishing this kind of violation of international law, but who are suffering, as you quite rightly point out, this hangover from, which I think is irrelevant, Ian, this hangover from the Bush years. It's one more toll of that era.
Well, Roger Morris, the liberals and progressives in this country used to be the heroes during going back in our foreign policy of being opposed to dictatorships, even when the U.S. was cozying up to the Somozas and the Shah and Marcos in the Philippines. And now they seem to be finding every excuse in the world to suggest somehow the rebels are behind this chemical attacks. I don't understand how liberals and progressives lost their moral compass.
Well, I'm not sure it was ever quite as pure as you're depicting it. We know that much of that was honored in the breach. We know that there was less courage in the inner councils of government than there seemed to be outside. Certainly, I was there during the Vietnam War when Bill Fulbright and a few brave voices on the Hill, George McGovern and others, Mark Hatfield, the liberal Republican, led the fight for so long. John Sherman Cooper, the great Republican senator from Kentucky. Those are all ghosts of the past who have no parallel at all with this dysfunctional and degraded system that we find ourselves with now. But I think it's worse than simple hypocrisy. I think we've lost very much any perception of the geopolitics at hand here. This is a policy, and I think that was lost years ago, not necessarily in Syria or the Middle East, although I think we did prevaricate there far too long, but certainly in Moscow. It's a reflection of the complete failure of the Obama administration's Russia policy, that we cannot even talk to the Russians. We do have common interests. We ought to have a more cooperative and collaborative view of policies like this. This is their last client left in the Middle East, and it is, of course, important for the stability of the region, especially in terms of what's happening now in Egypt and elsewhere. So I think that's a failure that Democrats simply don't come to grips with because they don't really understand the larger perspective here, and nor do they understand the reality inside Syria. As I said earlier, I know your earlier guest talked about the futility of some kind of partition that did not give the Alawis access to the sea, and I think that's certainly true. But there are ways, obviously, that diplomacy might at least respond to this crisis. We've seen none of that, none of the kind of serious discussion of partition or resolution that ought to have come out of this.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council's under President Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. And his new book is Between the Graves, about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on the comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. So, obviously, the Russians and the Americans have one thing in common. Neither want al-Qaeda to take over Syria. And when you say that, you know, you can't help thinking how absurd things have gotten. We have this this war on terror aimed at al-Qaeda, and yet our good Saudi friends are behind nurturing and arming this al-Nusra front that seems to be the most effective fighting force on the rebel side. So, and we are sort of dithering about saying what a terrible thing it would be for those people to take over. And Putin is saying, you know, you idiots, don't you understand? We're 500 miles away from these guys in the Caucasus, and you're going to end up with Somalia on the Mediterranean. So there's a lot to work with here, and Obama's going to be over there in the next couple of days. It seems like a no-brainer.
Well, it does seem like a no-brainer, and obviously Putin had a clearer vision of Russian national interest than we did of American national interest. You know, even the so-called evil patrons here of the Syrians, the Iranians and Hezbollah and others who are aiding and abetting, obviously have their own interests in the region that are paramount to the survival of the Assad regime. I think they should have been talked to as well as the Russians. The president talks constantly about mobilizing international coalitions and consulting with partners and all the rest, and his diplomacy, I think, couldn't be further from that ideal. This is a major failure of long-term American foreign policy. Ever since the fall, the 2011 fall of the Mubarak regime in Egypt, I think this administration has been at sea, and I think it remains there. And this is obviously, as everyone has pointed out with great anguish, a terrible and wrenching situation. It reminds me very much, Ian, of the Spanish Civil War, in which, of course, there were outside elements at work, and in the end, no negotiated settlement possible. There are these moments in geopolitics when you stare into the abyss, and the abyss simply stares back. I don't think there's a way the United States can fix this by covert action with the Free Syrian Army. I think those who know Syria doubt that the Free Syrian Army is any of that it's free, or that it's even predominantly Syrian in its supply, or that it's an army very much at this point. You do have a popular uprising against a wretched dictator, a mafia regime that's been in control for a long time, but which represents the interests, after all, of a sizable portion of the Syrian population. This is a sectarian and clan war, not just a Gaddafi-like dictatorship perched atop an oppressed country. This is much more complex than that, and quite frankly, it's beyond the analytical or instrumental ability of the United States at this point, given our firepower intellectually in foreign policy, to deal with. So I think that we're going to have to gird our loins here, expect a lot more horrible scenes like the ones we saw after the gas attack. Even the strikes that the administration is planning, even if they were moderately, in General Dempsey's terms, moderately successful, are not going to deter Assad from assuring his own survival. If he thinks his survival is at stake, he doesn't want to end up like Gaddafi in a ditch in a village, he will use whatever he has, and this is an extremely well-armed, fairly modern military arsenal.
Well, just in closing, Roger Morris, this peculiar alliance is between Democratic interventionists and Republican neoconservatives on one side and liberal Democrats and libertarian Republicans who are against Syrian intervention on the other. It again reminds me of the moral bankruptcy of liberals who used to be the champions against American foreign policy hypocrisy, supporting dictators around the world. and don't seem to be for anything anymore. They're just against things, but they're not for anything.
I think that's a very, very important point. I think this, what no one seems to be saying in this dialogue is how this is all going to bear on the midterm elections in 2014, and for that matter, on the presidential elections in 2016. The ghost in the rafters here is Rand Paul and the Tea Party resurgence inside the Republican Party. I'm not at all certain that Obama's going to win the House. I think that there's a real revolt against Boehner. It seems to me clear that the Republicans are going to have a foreign policy debate in 2014 and 2016, and it will be to the embarrassment and the shame, ultimately, of the liberals and the left of the Democratic Party, because they don't really have a foreign policy in, as you know, and they haven't had one for years. So we will have this neo-isolationist right-wing in some ways libertarian foreign policy, in some ways it's ersatz, but we will have that on one side, and on the other a kind of intellectual vacuum.
And of course it's Rand Paul that is filling that vacuum. He's a young college kids who used to gravitate to the left and now joining the libertarian fold. So
he's articulate, he's dynamic, he knows his stuff, he does his homework. I think his performance in the Foreign Relations Committee was relatively impressive. It certainly moved Rubio and some of his potential rivals in 2016 to palpably change their views and their positions. I think he's, at this point, he's probably the preeminent senator, if you discount Ted Cruz and that rump of the worst of reaction. But Rand Paul is going to be a formidable figure, and he's going to challenge the liberals right where they are most vulnerable, which is in international affairs.
And the liberal Markey voted present. So there you have it. I thank you for joining us, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. And he's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.